This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. There's another Supreme Court decision that we are waiting for. It's dealing with guns and expanding where people can carry them. The New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin, that's the name of the case. It's expected that the high court will expand access to guns in cities and states that restrict them. Not Texas, because we're already all in on carrying guns. But this is coming after high-profile mass shootings like in Uvalde and after the Senate has agreed on a bipartisan bill that will address gun safety. So how do we process all this, keeping in mind the Second Amendment as it is written, as it's been interpreted, and as we have been told it has been interpreted? There's a lot of conflict there. We're joined by Drew Stevenson, Wayne Fisher Research Professor at South Texas College of Law, visiting scholar at the University of Houston Law Center. And Drew Stevenson, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let me just start off by reading the Second Amendment. It's always fun to do that. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So self-explanatory, right, Drew? It's all right there.
Right. It's a little bit like reading one of the harder passages of the Bible. There's a lot of...
It's like reading alphabet soup, you know? It's just...
what's in the eye of the beholder.
So how do we get from that to an 18-year-old should be able to buy an AR-15?
Well, historically, what has happened is there's kind of two things going on. First of all, for most of our country's history... most courts and lawyers and law professors thought that the Second Amendment was about state militias and sort of the Revolutionary War era equivalent of the National Guard. And so that this was about the sort of precursor to the National Guard, and the well-regulated was very important. They didn't want the founding fathers were absolutely terrified of groups like that. Today we have Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and things like that, these sort of self-proclaimed militant groups. And the and they wanted, when they say well-regulated, then they meant something that is an arm of the state, like the National Guard. And then at the same time, though, we have to admit that guns have and violence have been a big part of our country's culture and history all along. And people have carried guns and so forth. There have been gun restrictions, especially on carrying guns in public over the years. And it wasn't really until we got to the Supreme Court's case in 2008 where they said that the Second Amendment actually implies an individual right to keep and bear arms. Now, that decision, which was District of Columbia v. Heller, expressly says that the Second Amendment is not absolute. In fact, it says just like all other constitutional rights. And I know that there are people out there who would like to assert that everything in the Constitution is absolute, but the people who get to make that decision are the courts, and the courts have not held that any rights are absolute, that they all have to be balanced. And so... Heller made it pretty clear that a state or city cannot have a straight-up gun ban, but it did say that it does nothing to affect longstanding prohibitions on, felons possessing guns or the ban on machine guns, certain types of unusually dangerous guns, and so forth. So that kind of brings us up to where we are. What has happened, though, is that since the 1990s, we haven't had, the 1990s were the last time we had federal legislation that actually added some restrictions on gun access. We have had some federal legislation to in the early 2000s to give immunity from lawsuits to gun manufacturers and gun stores. And so this has become a very politically charged issue, and now in the last decade has become a partisan issue as well. And as you can see, as you mentioned, we have increasingly frequent mass shootings and record numbers of gun deaths. in our society. Overall, there's been a significant decline in crime rates since the 1980s and early 90s. But the number of people who perceive that they're in danger from crime and want to own a gun to protect themselves has gone up, so that we're at a point now where we have more guns than people in our country.
Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Do you think that you have an absolute right to have a gun and be able to carry it anywhere you want and any gun that you want? Is that how you interpret the Second Amendment? Or do you think that that interpretation is wrong and that we need to go back to the original way that the Second Amendment was written, and that was what in 1791, how that was put into the Constitution? Call in 833-877-8255. So let's talk about this one phrase that is in the Second Amendment, is the right to keep and bear arms. That has been something that also Scalia went on about in the Heller decision, where he thought it meant that you could keep and carry a weapon as a civilian. But there have been scholars that say that look at how the phrase keep and bear arms was actually used during the crafting, at the time of the crafting of the amendments, the Bill of Rights. It actually was a phrase that was applied entirely to military usage. I mean, is that something that has been lost as well, Drew?
Well, I really have to acknowledge that there's an ongoing, very intense scholarly debate about this, with some very smart people on each side. The consensus among historians and linguists, people who studied the language at the time, seems to be that bear arms was almost always used in a military sense. And that when it's used as a couplet with keep and bear arms, that it was talking about being a part of a militia or being a sort of the precursor of the National Guard. There are, though, historians or especially legal scholars who would argue that gun ownership was very prevalent in most of the early, in all the early colonies except Pennsylvania, which was dominated by pacifist Quakers. And so it does seem that there were high rates of gun ownership and at the time, and that there are some kind of earlier antecedent legal rulings before the Constitution indicating that they didn't want the government to kind of disarm the population, that there was a fear of disarming people. And I also have to tell you that there is a hybrid view that has attracted a lot of scholars, that basically the understanding was that the militia, you weren't provided a state weapon. You were supposed to go. It was kind of a bring your own weapon to war type thing. And so they probably had trouble disentangling self-defense from serving in the militia, the way that we would do that today. So people today think that they have really separate in their mind keeping a gun in their home to defend against intruders or things like that versus volunteering for the National Guard.
Is there anything in the Constitution that mentions self-defense?
No, not really. The scholars and gun rights advocates who talk about self-defense will usually point to sources outside of the Constitution of legal writers from the time who talked about self-defense being a right under natural law or things like that, that they thought that there was sort of they will talk about a God-given right, which is kind of just a way to pound the table a little bit, right, to say, no, God is on my side in the argument. But they would talk about that there was some sort of natural right of self-defense and to arm yourself for self-defense. I also want to emphasize, though, that the original draft of the Second Amendment had an exception clause for people who are, it said, religiously scrupulous of bearing arms, basically conscientious objectors or people who don't who think it's wrong to use lethal force against other people. And they recognized that there were a lot of people in the early colonies like that who not only wouldn't serve in war, but went around unarmed when they were traveling in dangerous parts of the wilderness and so forth. And the Founding Fathers initially intended to protect those people as well.
So when it was drafted, the Second Amendment, the fact that it is the Second Amendment, not the First Amendment, second, does that mean anything?
No, because actually at the time it was debated in Congress, I think it was further down the list. It was there were a number of amendments that were all proposed. I can't remember right now if it was fourth or sixth. It was not originally debated or intended to be the Second Amendment. It's that some of the amendments did not get adopted by Congress and sent to the states for ratification. And so when you sort out of all of the amendments that were presented, the final list kind of got pared down, and this amendment about gun rights got bumped up to second place.
We're taking a break. We'll be right back. You can call in. We're going to get Lucy on the air and Jennifer right after this break. The number is 833-877-8255. We're talking about understanding the Second Amendment and also talk about gun violence in America. How does it impact us and the intersections with other issues? Even education, how does this impact education in America? We do want to hear from you. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about understanding the Second Amendment, and we're joined by Drew Stevenson, the Wayne Fisher Research Professor at South Texas College of Law, visiting scholar at the University of Houston Law Center. Our number is 833-877-8255. If you want to call in, we'd love to hear from you. We do have Lucy right now on the line. And Lucy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call. My question about the Second Amendment goes back to textual originalism. And it's my understanding that the framers of the Constitution, in making concessions to Southern states, put in the Second Amendment to allow them to establish militias to be able to go out and capture slaves who had run away. So this militia they're referring to is really sort of maybe a variation, an early part of the idea about Proud Boys, but it's some way of going out and capturing slaves or whatever else seems to be the, you know, the right focus of the right-wing agenda or, a capture agenda. Right. So what do you think about that?
Lucy, thank you for that call. Appreciate that. Drew Stevenson, what's your take on that?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because certainly there are some well-known scholars who have talked about the fact that the militias in the Revolutionary era in the Southern states were spent most of their time as slave patrols. And so I do think that from the Southern state standpoint, they wanted militia. The part of why the militia was so important to them to keep and to guarantee was that they saw it as a necessary in order to maintain their system of slavery that their economy depended on. But the militias meant different things to people from different states. And so there was no single view among the Founding Fathers. I mean, if you read the congressional debates about the Second Amendment, they had heated arguments. And so they weren't all necessarily on the same page about what this meant. And so for the northern states that where slavery was not as big a deal, they were wanting to annex or conquer more Indian territories. And so the militia was used to protect settlers or squatters from Indian raids from lands that they were taking. And so it kind of depended which state you were from, whether the militia and whether most of what you were doing with your weapons was maintaining slaves or conquering more territories from Native Americans, or maybe fending off a British or French invasion from Canada. And the one thing I can tell you, though, is that there's very few records of anybody at the time using guns against crime, right? Against the kind of like muggings or robberies or things like that. The guns that they had at the time and people carried with them would not have been very useful in a heat at the moment thing like that. They did use guns for dueling, though.
Hmm. Let's go to Juan on the phones. And Juan, you're on the air.
Yeah, I would like to ask, during the Wild West, what laws did the sheriffs and the marshals use to take away the guns of the citizens that were carrying guns all the time?
All right, Juan, thank you so much for that call. And here in San Antonio, this was the Wild West, and we certainly saw gun control was part of the local ordinances.
That's right. And so in most of the what we talk about is the Wild West, you had these wide open spaces that were not very well regulated or populated, and then you had towns and cities. And a lot, it was very common for the towns and cities to prohibit carrying the weapons in public within the city limits. You know, there's a famous movie about Tombstone, and in the signs, there's a photograph from the 1800s of the signs outside that basically you had to surrender your firearms, leave them at the police station or sheriff's station when you came into town, and you could pick them up when you left.
Right, they gave you a token. It was very common in the Wild West.
Right. That's right. And so anytime that you were going to be in a crowded place where there's lots of people, they knew that, you know, people get in fights and lose their temper. They get drunk and start brawling. All sorts of things go wrong. And when you put guns in that mix, it turns it deadly very quickly. And so they let people were more likely to have guns when they were kind of out on the open range than when they were in towns and cities. The other thing I want to add, though, is that Hollywood and before Hollywood, the radio shows and stuff like that have really created a lot of mythology and legends about the Wild West and how violent it was and how everybody had a gun that are not really historically accurate. Because it makes a much more entertaining movie if everybody is, you know, walking around with guns all the time. And historians would say that a lot of that is Hollywood, just Hollywood, basically.
Right. Let's go to another caller. We have Jennifer. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Yeah. If you want to be an originalist, then really you would consider today's personal weaponry more of a cannon than you would a gun. So I say for people like Scalia, do you really want to arm everyone with their own personal cannon? Because I don't see the framers as wanting that.
All right, Jennifer. So should originalists be thinking about flintlock muskets?
Right. That's a great question. And the fact is that there's if I had 10 originalists in the room, they would all have slightly different understandings of what originalists mean. But the fact is that most of the originalist legal scholar, I am not an originalist. I feel like the founding fathers they're not here, and we have to make decisions today. They left us with a legal system to decide where we could decide how to govern ourselves in our present time. So I'm not controlled by what somebody would have wanted who lived 200 years ago. But be that as it may, for the people who do believe in originalism, their argument is anything that was in common usage was what the founding fathers must have had in mind. And they don't mean muskets. They would then apply that principle to whatever are kind of common privately owned weapons nowadays. And of course, AR-15s are very, very have become very popular and much more affordable in the last few years, even though they were designed as weapons of war.
So I do want to ask you.
Caller makes a good point.
I want to ask you about, you know, you've written about how gun violence is impacting equality in education, and could you like take three or 4 minutes to talk about that?
So part of why this is such a difficult political issue, or it's so hard to get anything done to bring change, is the gun ownership is concentrated in rural areas, and gun violence is concentrated in areas of high population density like cities. And the way that, I don't want to get all boring, but there's the way our voting system is set up and our Senate system is set up, rural voters, your vote kind of counts more, or you have more voting power. And that is part of our problem. But the educational angle of this is there's more and more studies showing that it really affects the ability of kids to concentrate in schools, especially in the inner cities where they have classmates who have been killed walking home from school, and where the gun violence is so common, where people have lost family members, where they know that they are in danger all the time, not just in school, but outside of school, or they can sit in their classroom and hear gunfire on the streets outside. And this has a huge impact on their educational success. And so to the extent that we care about our kids and the future generation and their ability to be productive members of society, we invest a lot of resources in educating them, and then to have their neighborhoods swimming in guns and gun violence basically counteracts that. And then if you go to places like the suburbs, you know, I grew up kind of in the era when we were worried about nuclear wars, but the kids today have to do active shooter drills, right, and hide under their desk and pretend there's an active shooter. And there's a lot of studies indicating that this is really traumatizing for kids.
Right, and we're going to see in Uvalde that how well that actually works. I want to get one last caller in. James in on the air. James, you got about a minute. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that we also have to remember when the Second Amendment was written, which was basically right after the War of Independence against a tyrannical government who was trying to take the weapons away from the citizens. And on top of that, I mean, really, if you think about it, we wouldn't have Texas. It'd still be Tejas if each citizen didn't have a gun when they fought at the Alamo. And people that say, oh, well, you're not going to be against a modern army. Well, look at Afghanistan. They fought the Russians. They fought us with nothing but AKs and IEDs.
All right, James, thank you for that call. Appreciate that. And so if you could react to that, Drew Stevenson.
Well, first of all, there's not a lot of indication that the British had disarmed our population before the war started. Once we declared independence, there were some efforts to seize armories and stockpiles of weapons, but it's kind of a myth. I mean, the colonists were well-armed going into the war and everywhere except where the Quakers lived. And in terms of today, I really thought we lost at the Alamo. Maybe I learned wrong. But
we won the war. We won the war for independence.
We won the war, but I wouldn't point to the Alamo as the great success story of having how armed people can repel foreign invasions.
Those are fighting words, Drew Stevenson, here in San Antonio. Drew Stevenson is the Wayne Fisher Research Professor at South Texas College of Law, visiting scholar at the University of Houston Law Center. Thank you so much for talking with us today. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Jackie Velez and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.